Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Samira Agnihotri. She has worked in the Biligiri Rangan Hills in South India from 2005 when she began to study birdsong while pursuing a master's degree in wildlife biology and conservation from the National Center for Biological Sciences. She then studied vocal mimicry in racket-tailed drongos, walking through forests with a microphone and recorder, and obtained her PhD from the Indian Institute of Science. And as you've said in essays, you sort of attained your PhD in drongos because drongos have PhDs in other bird languages, which I hope you'll say too later. She followed up her research on drongos on a postdoctoral fellow at the National Institute of Advanced Studies. She's keenly interested in the traditional ecological knowledge of the Solega people and has dabbled in ethno-ornithologies, collaborating with linguist Dr. Aung Si, and is intent on documenting Solega knowledge and oral histories. Samira is also interested in nature education and in exploring different ways to popularize the ecological sciences as well as encourage and aid the preservation of traditional knowledge systems. She's a member of the Punarchith, I'm sorry, I mispronounced that horribly, a collective that works with farmers and rural youth. Currently, she works at the Office of Communications at the Indian Institute of Science. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks, Derek. Thanks for that introduction.
And I'm sorry again about the mispronunciations.
No, I think you did really well.
Oh, thank you. I should learn from the drongos how to mimic, should I not?
Yes, absolutely.
So I don't think that most of the people hearing this have ever heard of racket-tailed drongos. Can you just introduce them for a while and then say why you love them and how you fell in love with them?
Sure. So racket-tailed drongos are completely black birds found in tropical forests across Southeast Asia. And they're really beautiful to look at. They have two long tail feathers, that follow them when they're flying. And they have this crest on their head, so it gives them a lot of attitude. They look like really royal creatures, to me at least. And they are known for their mimicking abilities by bird-watching communities across the Old World tropics at least, wherever they are found. And how I fell in love with racket-tailed drongos is, well, as you'd mentioned, I was doing my master's in the Biligiri Rangan Hills, and for my research, I was recording the calls of many different species of birds. And one day, we came across this blackbird that I was talking about, and it was making the calls of many different species of birds. And when I say we, I mean my Solega companion and I, and we were mesmerized by what I would call, an acoustic display or a performance. And we wondered why it was mimicking these different species of birds. And at that time, my companion, whose name is Madha, mentioned, or rather joked, that I should do my PhD on the racket-tailed drongo because it seems to be doing its PhD on all the other birds because it could speak like all the other birds. And we laughed, and it was just a joke at that time. But, a lot of research is also serendipity, and I ended up actually pursuing these birds for my further studies and for all my research so far, actually. And it's not just their mimicry that captivates me. I mean, of course, that's phenomenal, and it's amazing the way their ability to copy the sounds of other species of not just birds, but also mammals and other creatures. And the just thinking about why they do this, it kind of occupies a large part of my brain. But also, they also do many other really interesting and cool things that indicate that birds, not just racket-tailed drongos, but birds are really, really cognitively far more advanced than we think they are. And bird brain, which is an insult, should actually be a great compliment.
So I would love to get into that more in a little while. But before we go there, can you talk a little bit more about the mimicry and why are some of the reasons they mimic? And one of the things in reading about your work that I didn't know before about these birds is that they will sometimes be in mixed flock. So what's the relationship between the mimicry and a mixed flock? And just anything else you want to say about it?
Yeah. So mixed flocks or mixed hunting parties, also sometimes called as bird waves, are gatherings of different species of mostly birds, but also sometimes smaller mammals like squirrels and shrews in a patch of forest. So you would expect that, well, theory tells you that each animal is selfish and it forages for itself in its own space, but that's not really true. Especially in the tropics, these mixed hunting parties or gatherings of different species are very well known. And they're called bird waves because when you're walking in a forest, you will see this congregation pass you by. You'll see a lot of activity, you know, different birds, right from the ground to all the levels of the forest, what we call, you know, the understory and the mid canopy and the upper canopy. There are different species moving through all the layers of the forest, so to speak, and that's why it's also known as a bird wave. And well, if you experience it once, you'll never forget it. It's quite dramatic. And racket-tailed drongos have been known to be always found within these flocks. They're regular participants. And the theories so far are that mixed species flocks happen because, it's easier to find food and if you're in a group and that there is protection from predators because there are lots of eyes and the competition amongst each other is less because you're different species. So you are able to hang out together because you're not really competing for the exact same thing. You are your own species and you have your own niche, so to speak, where you will be. But at the same time, you are part of a larger cohesive group. I'm not sure if this is making sense. You really have to experience it when, you have to see it in front of you, but just think of it as a large group of birds moving through a patch of forest together, looking for insects.
So, and I'm sorry for the ignorance of this question, but until your work, I didn't know these. Maybe because there aren't enough birds here, or maybe because I don't live in the tropics. I know about other interspecies cooperation, like badgers and coyotes sometimes hunt prairie dogs together. So if the prairie dog goes down a hole, the badger goes in, and if it runs not in the hole, the coyote goes after it. Or also groupers and moray eels, I believe, will sometimes, the moray eel will be hanging out in its little, in the little cave where it lives, and the grouper will come and shake its head outside, which is an invitation to come hunt. And then they will go together, and same deal, that if the fish stays in a crevice, the moray eel goes in, but if it goes out, then the other fish goes after it. So I've heard of those, but can you talk a little bit more about just a bird wave? Because, I mean, is it like two species or 10 species? And are we talking 20 birds or 200 birds or... And does this last for 3 minutes that they hang out together, or do they do this all day? I have never been introduced to these before.
Right. Yeah. So it's more than two birds or three birds for sure, but the number of species and the number of individuals in the bird wave or the flock or the hunting party varies from place to place and from time to time. And these mixed hunting parties are found across the tropics, even in South America. They're very well known, and there's a lot of research that has been conducted on them. Let me tell you how it feels to be watching a bird wave. So there are usually up to, on average, in at least in the areas where I work, there are 20 to 50 individuals, and these may be, anywhere from 10 to 15 species or more. And there's another really interesting thing about these bird waves is that there are lots of species which are gregarious. So, for example, there are these babblers which live in family flocks, or, you know, they move around anyway in flocks of 10 to 12 individuals. And these gregarious species, like babblers, are also always part of these hunting parties or these bird waves. And but they still join. You would think that, you know, if I live in a large group, why do I need to join a larger group? So there are these are questions that we don't really have the answers, definite answers for, but they do. So there are these gregarious species, there are drongos, there are sometimes barbets, and you may not know these species, but just to give you an idea, there are bulbuls. There are lots of species, and they stay together for several hours, not just for a few minutes, but they will move through the forest together. Yeah. So they will spend time in a particular patch of forest, maybe for half an hour or an hour if you're lucky. And then they will move to a different patch. And it's very dynamic. The other species join and leave, and you know, it's not a fixed idea. It's not a fixed identity that the flock has. Species and individuals keep joining and leaving as the flock moves.
And so now, thank you so much for all that. I think that's really interesting. And can you now relate that to the mimicry?
Yeah, so racketed drongos mimic a lot of species that form these flocks that are part of these bird waves. They also, but that's not the only mimicry they do, and that's the important part. They mimic many other things as well, but I'll come to that a little later. But in my 15 years of observations, I really believe that the racket-tailed drongo uses mimicry to affiliate with the other members of these mixed species flocks. So for example, I am a racket-tailed drongo, and I hang out with these other birds because they disturb a lot of insects when they are moving through the forest as a flock. And I just hang out with them, and I talk like them, and I don't really hunt too much myself, but because I talk like them, I can, you know, hang out with them. And also, I believe that the racket-tailed drongo uses the mimicry to even locate these flocks or locate individual species in these flocks. So just to illustrate, I have seen many, many times racket-tailed drongos will mimic a particular species, let's say a woodpecker, which is not present near it at that moment. And it will keep on mimicking that species until it hears a response from an actual woodpecker or a babbler that it is mimicking from a little distance away, and then it flies towards that. And then it just hangs out with the woodpecker or the babbler and happily eats whatever these birds are disturbing. And this is interesting because it's all... in our research, we are taught to think in terms of costs and benefits. You know, what is the cost to the other birds to have the racket-tailed drongo mimic them? What is the benefit to the drongo to hang out with these other birds? And sometimes it's not possible to measure these costs and benefits in the way that can be easily translated in terms of research, right? I'm not sure if I'm saying this correctly, but you have to really be there for many, many years to observe these interactions to even be able to get your finger on what's going on.
So you raise a hugely important point. And, before I critique science here, I'm just going to mention that I have a degree in physics myself. So, I do understand science some. And so I see bears every day, and I see lots of bears every day. And just today, I was watching two adult bears who are not relatives playing. and they were just play fighting, they're wrestling around, and they're like any other young people who feel good, you know? And when you said, the reason I'm sort of stammering and the reason I'm saying any of this is because I think that the whole cost benefit thing can be a useful tool. And at the same time, isn't it possible? I mean, isn't it sometimes just sufficient that maybe, the Drongo might be calling some friends or might be saying hello or might be just being a neighbor? I mean, isn't that okay to talk about too?
Exactly. So, because I've spent so much time in the forest watching these birds, I know that the same set of individuals occupy, say, a territory, right? So if I go to place X in the forest, I know that I'm pretty sure that I will find a racket-tailed drongo and a mixed species flock there at some point in the day, okay? And it's the same birds day in and day out, year after year. So they know each other. It's not like it's not a one-day interaction or a two-day interaction. These birds live with each other. There is a network. It's a community. They interact with each other every single day. So when people say that the racket-tailed drongo uses mimicry to, in quotes, fool other birds, I'm not buying it. Because why would these other birds continue to be fooled by racket-tailed drongo's mimicry every day? I'm pretty sure there's something much more complex happening. I don't know what it is, but it's definitely, nobody's being fooled here, right? Because it's like you said, they're neighbors, they're friends, they know each other. And how do you measure that? How do you, in terms of research in the restrictive confines of how we define and conduct our research, how do you explain that? So before I end this section, the answer to this, I also want to say that I'm now trying to apply, it's still restrictive, but I'm now trying to apply theories or methods from language studies or linguistics, you know, something called conversation analysis, I'm sorry, that is used in language studies, how analysis of people talking to each other. And I want to apply this to these networks of birds and see who's saying what and how it affects, you know, their relationships. And mimicry is an important part of that. So,
I have two questions. One of them is, so can you talk, unless the research is at such an early stage that you can't really talk about it, can you talk about that conversation analysis as it would, well, first off, what it is, and then also how it would apply here. And then also, mimicry, isn't mimicry how humans learn language too? Isn't that how children learn to speak the language that becomes their native language?
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of similarity in the ways that birds learn to speak and the way human babies learn to speak. You know, the babbling that babies do and the way that baby birds start learning to vocalize. There are a lot of similarities in the way they learn in the brain, you know, what goes on in the brain and in the kinds of frequencies that humans hear and in birds hear. So there's a lot of similarity there. And exactly, I do believe that the origins of even human language, like you said, had to do with mimicry. Perhaps we started learning to speak by imitating the other creatures that we heard around us. This is just a theory. There is some evidence from language studies on this as well, but nobody's really looked at it in great detail because obviously, you know, there is not enough evidence. It was so many years ago when man started, or humans, to be politically correct, started learning to speak. And mimicry plays a great role in that. So, to answer your other question about conversation analysis in human speech is a technique used to study how the way or what people say in conversations affects each other. So what is the context in which a conversation is being carried out? And this is especially useful in what is known as code switching in language studies, which is when people speak in the same conversation in different languages. And I don't know how common that is in places like USA and Europe, but in a country like India and in many other countries, it's very common for people to know multiple languages, including English. And often when we find a speaker of our own language, just think of a French person. If when they find somebody who speaks French, there's an immediate affiliation, there's a bond. You can't deny it. They will immediately start speaking in French. And that's the beauty of language. It creates affiliations. And when people do this in a conversation, when I'm speaking in English and if I suddenly switch to French, because I want to direct my speech to a particular person around me who understands French, right? And there's all kinds of other things that one can think of as to why, what happens to the other people in the audience and so on and so forth. But what I'm trying to say is that I really believe that the racket-tail rongo's mimicry is also creating this affiliative bond. It's speaking the language of another species, and it's directing the attention of another species towards itself by speaking its language. And this is where the similarity between conversation analysis and bird talk lies, I think. I haven't yet done this, but this is something that I want to. In my mind, I see these as parallel, phenomenon.
So I love what you're saying. That and it makes me think of I remember a time in my early 20s when I was playing baseball with a bunch of people who spoke Spanish but not English, and we're obviously the same species, but we didn't speak the same language. Except we still, because we all know the rules of baseball, we were able to have fun and hang out together. And then had I been able to speak some Spanish, we would have made another bond besides that. But I'm thinking of all these different species, hanging out, and they all generally know the rules of what they're doing. We're all, I'm going to look for insects over here. Let me know if this is all complete crap. I'm going to look for insects over here. You're going to look for insects over there. We're going to hang out together. And they know those rules. And then an additional bond can be created if the drongo then says something in their language. Am I off track, or is this in any way in the right area?
No, absolutely. That's exactly what I was trying to say. And it's interesting because it's even more interesting because the drongos are really aggressive birds. They're fearless. So if there is anything that a threat to the birds in that area, say a sparrowhawk or an eagle or, any other predator, it will attack that creature. The other birds also attack. It's not just the drongo that's attacking, but perhaps, it's a kind of a long-term give and take between this community that hangs out together, I'm going to look for insects today, and you don't need to do the hard work of looking for insects. You can eat the insects that I'm disturbing, but I'll be friends with you because you speak like me, and perhaps we can all get together and chase off those threatening creatures.
So this is predicated. I mean, everything we're talking about right now is predicated on birds being subjective beings, and as opposed to sort of the mechanistic beast machines who act only, who don't have personalities or friends or acquaintances. So that there's this implicit assumption, it seems to me, which I like, in everything you're saying, that these, that all of these different bird species are their own subjective beings with personalities and relationships.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, anybody who's kept pets knows that animals have personalities, right? No two dogs are the same. No two cats are the same. So it's not really hard to imagine that wild animals would also have differing personalities, right?
So a question that you have been asked in interviews that I really love your answer to has to do with, so why do this research? What are the applications? How can we use this to, I don't know, make better buildings or to advance the field of human psychology? Isn't all this, and I know I'm being kind of aggressive and insulting here, but isn't all this research just useless?
Yeah, it depends on who's running the world and who's giving you money for the research, I guess. But I don't think it's useless, obviously, because I've been doing it for so long. But it is very difficult to find support for this kind of research because, like you said, it doesn't have, in quotes again, any application or even any, it's not even conservation because this bird is not endangered. It's not a charismatic large animal like the tiger or elephants, and nothing against them, but it's the way we've related to these large species that is, I think, a huge problem because we tend to forget that it's not about one species, but it's about the interactions between all the species and all the plants and the insects and us too as well. You know, we are a part of it. That is the most important thing. And so if I'm studying racket-tailed rhombos and I'm trying to understand how and why they talk to other birds and why do they mimic, maybe it doesn't have any immediate applications, but you know, maybe it, like you said, I believe it might give us insights into how we learn to speak as human beings or even something else. But why do we need to have applications for all research? Well, so people also tell me that it's taxpayers' money, so it needs to have applications. I understand that to some level, but most applicative research is based on fundamental research that didn't start out with having, you know, a goal of application in mind. So, yeah, that's my answer right now.
So everything you're saying, and ever since I learned about your work at all, I keep thinking about something that so many Indigenous people have said to me, which is that, I mean, many, many Indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and Indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive the world as consisting of resources, which includes intellectual resources, as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. Or another way to say it is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive, Westerners obviously, you know, I mean non-Indigenous, generally perceive the world, don't understand that listening to the land is the way the world really works. They still think it's a metaphor. And that's one of the things that I have just loved about your work from the beginning is that you're not approaching these birds even as an intellectual resource. Sure, you're curious about them, but like you said, it's all about your relationship to them, their relationship to you, their relationships to each other. And that seems to me to be a profoundly important and necessary way to perceive the world.
Yes, absolutely. This is, I think this is really, really important, Derek. And I've been shamelessly, and I'm going to say it shamelessly, I've been greatly influenced by the time I spent with the Indigenous community in the area that I work, who call themselves the Soliga. And, I do receive a lot of flack for that. And I don't have a romantic view of the noble savage at all, right? It's just that I feel that there are multiple ways of knowing, of knowledge production, and the best insights, and you can only really understand something when these multiple ways of knowing merge, when you're open to learning from these other knowledge systems, for example. And I just want to say here that, you know, the Soliga, the Indigenous community that I mentioned, they, like you said, they don't have this separation of nature and humans, but, you know, in their mythology or in their belief system, it's all connected. And even so, in their language, they don't call animals it. Or if they do, they call themselves also it. You know, the way they speak, I'm not sure if I'm making sense, but there is the differentiation is very, very, it's not as stark as you see in the Western world. And the Racketel Rongo, to them, they didn't know about the mimicry at all, which was really interesting to me. But in their belief system, all animals have... Like in humans, in the Soliga themselves, they have a social system where, you know, there are different kinds of leaders. And there are different names, but I'm not going to go into that here. But there is a person who was in charge of, you know, keeping law and order in the community. There's a person who's in charge of solving disputes. So equivalents of, you know, what we would call, a judge, a policeman, and so on and so forth. And they believe that every group of animals has the exact same social system. So birds have a species that is the leader, which is and a policeman and a judge, and so do mammals, and so do insects, and it goes on like that. And to them, the racket-tailed rongo is a kolukara or a stick bearer or a policeman. You know, acts like a policeman and takes the bribe of one feather from every single species that it guards over, right? So I found this really interesting because they've clearly observed these mixed species flocks and, you know, the interactions that take place and perhaps the racket-tailed rongo being aggressive towards these threatening birds that I was talking about earlier. And they have come up with their own way of explaining this. They don't talk about the mimicry, they don't talk about cost-benefit analysis or any of those things, but they do have some understanding of it, right? And I thought that there's a lot that we can learn from the way indigenous communities experience nature.
And I love the understanding that there are different roles played by different members of the community, and especially the notion that, okay, so I'm going to back up a second, and I wrote a book called The Myth of Human Supremacy a few years ago, and one of the things I wrote about in there was plant communication, and it ends up that if a caterpillar is eating the leaves of certain sorts of plants, they will send out a chemical message to other plants saying, hey, we're being eaten by caterpillars. You might change the composition of your leaves to make it so they taste less good to these insects. Okay, you with me so far?
Yeah.
Okay, so I thought that was really cool. And then I was reading about some of the plant researchers who were doing this, and some of them are great. And then there were a couple plant researchers who were saying, we don't understand how this would ever work, because why would one plant of one species tell one of the competitors in the forest that they're being eaten by caterpillars, why would they help the other plants like this? And it made no sense to them. And when I read that, I started just pulling out my hair thinking, don't you understand the concept of neighbors?
Yeah.
I mean, the reason the plants do this is because they understand that the forest doesn't just consist of one plant. It consists of all their neighbors.
Yes, absolutely. I'm glad you brought this up because this is, again, something that I feel really strongly about. And as far as now we know, there's the wood wide web, right? So we know about all these fungal interactions that happen through the roots of trees and how they talk to each other and how they're all connected. So, I don't know what plant scientists, whether all plant scientists agree, but I think there is consensus that even trees talk to each other through different ways of communication. And as for this idea of why would an individual, whether it's a tree or a bird or, you know, anything in nature, why would it help another competitor? I find this whole idea really problematic because it's something that's come from mainstream education perhaps, or My apologies, but Western and white views of the nature-cultural divide. But we are taught from the very beginning that, you know, everything in nature is about competition and, you know, it's eat or be eaten and survival of the fittest and things like that. Well, that may be true to some extent, but it's actually what I have seen and what many of my colleagues have seen. If you just have the eyes and the ears to listen and to see, and you need to spend a lot of time, is that cooperation is the norm, not competition. Right? I mean, it just doesn't work. If everybody was competing with each other, things would die out very soon. This is really radical what I'm saying, but I really believe that we need to move away from focusing on competition as being the central theme of things in nature and try to look at how cooperation is perhaps the norm.
Well, a couple of things. One is that for years when I gave talks, one of the things I would do is I would say I can disprove that evolution is based on hyper-exploiting your surroundings in one sentence if you give me a couple of semicolons. And that's those creatures who have survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by actually improving your habitat. So the question for me is, like, how do you, as a member of your community, how do you actually, and this is by you, I mean you personally, I mean you as a human, I also mean you as a racket-tailed drongo, I mean you as an elephant, it doesn't matter. How do you actually improve your habitat? Because that's how habitat got rich in the first place, is by everybody living and dying. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yes, but are you asking me whether...
I'm just throwing that out, and you can take it anywhere you want. Or if you don't want to take it anywhere, I'll just ask another question.
Yeah. I mean, if you're agreeing with me that, you know, things evolve so much and became so diverse because they got along with each other in different ways, and they, in order to improve the habitat around them, like you said, or in order to maintain, you know, things, then I agree. But if you're playing devil's advocate, and if you're asking me how things evolved and to be so diverse without competition, then I don't have all the
No, I was not playing devil's advocate. And I do agree. Okay, so I see bears all the time, and there's a mother with two babies that's out there these days. And this happens so often when they have two babies. One of them is really aggressive, and one of them is really timid. And for several years, I wondered, how does that work? Because the aggressive one will steal food from the other one. And then one day it occurred to me that the aggressive one also takes more risks, which means that if anybody's going to fall out of a tree, it's going to be the aggressive one. If anybody walks too far away from the mother and gets killed by a bigger bear, it's going to be the aggressive one. And so those are two survival strategies. And the point is, bears have figured out that it really works best to have multiple to have babies with different personalities. So I'm just saying that a sort of strict Richard Dawkins selfish gene idea would say, oh, they have to be the most aggressive. But that just, it doesn't even work on that scale.
Exactly. In fact, there is a lot of research on animal personalities now that talks about exactly what you're saying, that it's like we say we need to conserve biodiversity and a diversity of species. We also need to conserve a diversity of personalities within species, or even in any species, even humans, right? I mean, it's all the more interesting if all of us were equally aggressive or equally meek. It just wouldn't work. It would be, first of all, really boring, and I'm pretty sure we wouldn't survive as a species. So yeah, absolutely, I completely agree with you that it's important to acknowledge the benefits of perhaps having different types of personalities across all species on Earth.
So perceiving the birds as being beings of their own, with their own personalities, etc. Does that make it harder for you to do your work, or is your work well accepted in the field, in your field, and a lot of scientists agree with you?
Oh, I have to say very few people agree with me. because, and I think that my views give me extraordinary and special insights into the world of birds, for example, or into the way animals communicate with each other, and also into how humans communicate with each other. But everybody says interdisciplinary, you know, research is very exciting and we should do it, but nobody actually wants to understand it or supports it too much because it's hard. It takes many, many years and it's not easy to do. And like we discussed earlier, it doesn't have any immediate applications for the benefit of mankind. So, yeah.
So I want to sort of take the interview a different direction. And I know that we've been talking about them doing all this mimicry or this different languaging as, you know, being friendly or anything else. But now I'm going to go back and go a utilitarian question. And sorry about this, but I don't know how else to ask it. You know, sort of a cost benefit question. How does it help them? Why would they mimic, unless it's just for fun, which is okay, why would they mimic 3 species of mammals and 2 species of frogs and an insect? Why do they do that?
Yeah, so racket and drongos, I think that the reasons why they mimic are multiple reasons. And one of them is just the mixed species flock angle that we were talking about earlier. But they also use mimicry to perhaps woo each other, you know, and both males and females call in this species. Males and females look alike. You can't differentiate between them when you see them. And perhaps in other species of birds that do mimic, like bowerbirds and lyrebirds, for example, in Australia, it's known that the one that mimics more species and more accurately is more attractive. So that could be one of the reasons also why they mimic these insects and frogs, because they're showing off. It could be that, you know, see, hey, look, I can do so many different things. And does that interest you? And in terms of, you know, how is it a fitness benefit to them? Perhaps individuals that are able to mimic better are also able to feed their young better because, you know, they can build more affiliations with other species, find more food. And so it's attractive in the world of racket-tailed drongos to be able to mimic more and better. And perhaps if I can mimic, you know, say a crow when I see an eagle or an eagle when I see a crow, I can, you know, scare them away easier. I think there can be multiple benefits to, you know, the racket-tailed drongos being able to mimic many different species. And I know we're running perhaps out of time, but I really want to also talk about one other observation. When you're talking about 3 species of mammals that the racket-tailed drongos mimic, these are squirrels and monkeys. And it is usually the alarm calls of these squirrels and monkeys that the racket-tailed drongos mimic. And when I was talking about communication networks earlier, and we've heard on so many occasions, there are these animals called giant squirrels in the forest. They're really big, and they have 2 different types of alarm calls. One is an alarm call for an aerial threat. So when there's a threat from above, say an eagle flies past, and the other alarm call is a different sound that's meant for a threat from the ground, you know, something that climbs up the tree, like human beings or leopards, for example. And, when I hear a giant squirrel giving an alarm call, you know, some distance away because there's an eagle flying overhead. And then I hear a racket-tailed drongo making the same alarm call. So, and I wonder, is it passing on this signal to all the species in the forest? Is there, like, you know, a network amongst these animals in the forest that live together, like I was talking about, a giant squirrel that lives next to a drongo, and they know each other? and they're just passing on the message. And the question that people ask me is, why would the Racketeer Rongo not make its own alarm call, right? And I say it's because the giant squirrel's alarm call signifies a particular thing, which is the aerial threat. The threat is an eagle. And the racketeel is trying to tell everybody else that there's an eagle.
I love this. This is great. And another thing I'm thinking, when you were talking about the attractiveness, I was also just thinking, you know, if we really do take this notion that non-humans are subjective beings of their own, I mean, why do humans dance? Why do humans, yeah. I mean, there's the cliche of people at a club or something and, you know, somebody who's a better dancer, more people look at them or, you know, why do people play pool or why do people, oh, this is a silly story, but when I was 20, I was a high jumper. And I remember one time I was hanging out with some friends and we saw this group of women a little ways away. I'm like 20 years old. We saw this group of women a little ways away. And I said to my friends, I'm going to jump over that fence right there to really impress them. And I did. I jumped over the fence. I'm halfway up and I'm thinking, this is the stupidest thing I've ever done. And of course it didn't, I have no idea if it impressed them or not. I never ended up talking to them, but I mean, it's kind of like bears. I see this all the time. Male bears will try to impress females by, well, a couple ways. One is they will stand on their hind legs and grab maybe a 10 or 15 foot tall tree and break it over their back. And wow. Another thing they'll do is they will walk stiff legged and pee. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not a bear, so I don't know why that impresses the females. But it just, I loved what you said about maybe it's just a way of being attractive. And, you know, God knows we do lots of crazy things to try to make ourselves attractive.
Exactly. But I do want to say, you know, we are so focused on males of a species trying to be more attractive. But I do want to say that females do it as well, perhaps as much as males do. You know, everybody wants to be attractive. Yeah.
So we only have a few minutes left, and I guess I don't know if this is a fair question, but I mean, I love what you're saying about the drongos, and what are the? Oh, I guess a couple questions. One of them is that before we started the recording, when you and I were just chatting, we talked about how there's this guy who studies prairie dogs, who I have a lot of respect for, Khan Slobachikov, who studies them only in nature, and everybody wants him to capture prairie dogs and put them in the lab. And you seem to resonate with that story. And so I just want to talk about, I want you to talk for a moment about your methodology of, it seems to me to be just going and observing. So can you talk a little bit about methodology, and then can you sort of, and then the implications of your work for how we perceive nature. And then also, if people want to know more about your work, how can they find out more about it? So sorry, that's so much to throw into 3 minutes, but can you go anywhere you want with any of that?
Yes. Perhaps I'll go backwards. If to know more about my work, they can just Google me, or, you know, you can share my email ID. That's not a problem. Methods. Yeah, when we study animal behavior, it's mostly just observation, and you try to be as non-intrusive as possible, at least I do, and to kind of merge with the surroundings so that you're sure that what you're observing is not something that is directed at you being there, but in fact is what these birds would be doing in their natural surroundings anyway. You don't want to influence their behavior in any way, ideally, right? But at the same time, they're not dumb and they can see you, and you can hope that they perhaps get used to being there, and so they kind of ignore you after a while, which is what we call habituation. But there are limits to what you can study with these methods. Well, limits in terms of the current way academia is structured. People tell me, I often say that perhaps drongos or birds sing or mimic because they're being playful or because it makes them happy. And then, of course, the question is, how can you prove that? And then you can only prove it by catching these birds and putting, electrodes in their brains or doing things to them in the lab. And thankfully, it's illegal in India to have these wild species in captivity. But also I would never want to do that because that's very intrusive. And secondly, I'm not sure how useful it is for me to study something by cutting it down in a lab, whereas when I can easily observe, them in their natural state in the wild. I've also often been asked, what is the function of these long tail feathers? Why do these birds have these long tail feathers? Because both males and females have them. And then I say, I have no idea. And they're like, oh, you should catch them and cut them and reattach different lengths and see how that works. And I'm like, why would I want to do that? It's okay to not know some things, right? Why are we so obsessed with finding answers to everything in the way we want, boxing things? It's okay if I can't study some aspects, it's fine. I'm also not okay with the conventional method of, banding birds with color bands. I have done it myself because, that was expected of me. But I am not sure. I mean, it's almost like putting, it's like putting a number on a prison inmate. It's like a label, and those birds can see in color. We don't know what effect that would have in the community. Do birds that are banned, are they more attractive to other birds? How does it affect their life? We have no idea. So I'm all for, to cut it short, I'm all for really, really non-invasive methods. And where the species that you're studying should be really the priority, and not cutting it, or not your research, but the species should be the priority. I forgot, what was the other thing you asked me?
Well, I think you've made it clear. The other thing was just the implications of your work for our relationship with nature.
Yes. I wouldn't want to say too much about it, but I really feel that we are, as a race, as a species, humans have removed themselves from nature in very harmful ways. And perhaps just going back to just listening to, the sounds around us, the sounds of other creatures, is a way to heal ourselves, to bring us back to the way we were supposed to connect to the world around us. I'm not sure if I answered your question, but I think I would like to just say that much for now. Yeah.
And then I know that was going to be the end, but I want to say one more thing, which is that I know for me, I mentioned the bears before. I know for me, the happiest I am is when I see the bears and they aren't looking at me. They aren't noticing me so much, but they're simply being bears. Like today when I mentioned that the two bears were roughhousing, and that makes me happiest when I see them in circumstances where I'm not affecting them at all. And can you just mention that joy of being in nature and seeing wild animals and plants being themselves?
Yes, absolutely. It makes me happiest too when I feel like I'm a part of, where I am in the forest, and I'm not an outsider looking in. I sense things and I feel things the way everybody else. And when I say everybody else, I mean trees and plants and insects. And I know they see me and I see them, and that's okay. They're not reacting to me. I know we're running out of time, but I'll quickly just say one more thing, is that, there are lots of tigers in the forests that I work, and let me tell you that they have seen me a million times more than I have seen them. So it's very special when a tiger chooses, or any other animal chooses, to display themselves or chooses to come out in the open in front of you, because it shows, it's a sign that you're not interfering with them, they're not scared of you, and that's just the most wonderful feeling.
Well, thank you for all of that, and thank you so much for your work in the world, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Samira Agnihotri, and let's spell that so people can look her up. S-A-M-I-R-A space AGNIHOTRI, so you can look her up. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.